From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss presidential hopeful George W. Bush with journalist Bill Minutaglio, the author of the new biography, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Minutaglio is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. We'll examine the controversies that have surrounded George W. Bush from his college days as head of his fraternity to his work in his father's presidential campaigns and his track record as governor of Texas. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the dot-com craze started by the internet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton urged other countries today not to use yesterday's Senate vote on the nuclear test ban treaty as an excuse to start testing nuclear weapons. He said the U.S. won't resume its own testing as long as he's president, and he accused Senate Republicans of partisanship and turning to what he called a new isolationism. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott said senators voted their consciences not for partisan reasons, but because the treaty was flawed. Other nuclear nations reacted with disappointment to the Senate's rejection of the test ban treaty. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from London.
Russia today accused the United States of undermining world stability and said it was disillusioned and seriously concerned by the vote. The defeat of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty made the United States the first nuclear power to specifically reject the 154-nation agreement. French President Jacques Chirac, who had appealed to the Senate with Britain's Tony Blair and Germany's Gerhard Schroeder, called the defeat a setback to the entire process of disarmament. Of the five major nuclear powers, only Britain and France have ratified the treaty. China and Russia were awaiting U.S. action. The Senate's rejection may take the pressure off India to sign the treaty. Delhi shocked the world with underground nuclear tests in May 1998 that were quickly followed by detonations from its rival Pakistan. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
Colorado Governor Bill Owens has appointed a team of lawyers to advise him on whether to appoint a special prosecutor in the JonBenet Ramsey murder case. The move comes just a day after a Boulder grand jury ended its 13-month investigation by saying there wasn't enough evidence to indict anyone. The 6-year-old beauty contestant was found dead in her family home nearly 3 years ago. 2 days after deposing the prime minister in a military coup, the Pakistan army chief has declared martial law. Tuscola Bruner reports from Islamabad.
Army Chief General Pervez Musharraf has suspended Pakistan's constitution, parliament, and all governments in the country's 4 provinces. The president will remain in office. General Musharraf has become the chief executive of the country. On Tuesday, the army deposed the unpopular Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in a bloodless coup. Sharif and his top government officials were arrested and are being held in an undisclosed location. The army said one reason it staged the coup was to prevent General Musharraf's assassination. The general was returning from Sri Lanka on Tuesday, and the government refused to allow his plane to land in Karachi. After being diverted from its course, the plane landed with 7 minutes of fuel to spare. For NPR News, I'm Tuscola Carla Bruner in Islamabad.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 54 points today to close at 10,286. This is NPR News. Election officials in Iowa say the state's presidential nominating caucuses will be held on January 24th next year, a week earlier than previously scheduled. Joyce Russell reports from member station WOI in Des Moines.
Iowa law requires that 8 days elapse between the Iowa caucuses and the nation's first presidential primary in New Hampshire. The tradition is aimed at preserving the importance of both states in the nominating process. A dark horse candidate can do well in Iowa and then have 8 days to capitalize on it. Today's change came about because officials in Delaware considered February 8th for their primary. That led New Hampshire to move its contest up to February 1st, leaving only 1 day instead of 8 between Iowa and New Hampshire. Party officials in Iowa today expressed guarded optimism that the January 24th date will now stand. It's a full 3 weeks earlier than the February Iowa caucuses held in the last election cycle. For NPR News, I'm Joyce Russell in Des Moines.
An Indiana jury began deliberating today in the murder trial of Orville Lynn Majors, a former nurse accused of killing 7 Page patients with drug injections. Prosecutors said Major killed the patients when he worked at the Vermilion County Hospital from 1993 to 1995. Defense attorneys told the jury that it was clear that all the patients died of natural causes. Medical experts testified that the deaths were consistent with lethal doses of potassium chloride, epinephrine, or both. Family doctors of some of the patients testified that they believed the deaths were caused by illnesses that sent the patients to the hospital to begin with. In stocks, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 6 points to close at 2,807. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that Texas Governor George W. Bush wants to be our next president, there's a lot of curiosity about him, his past, and his track record. My guest, Bill Monotaglio, has written a new biography called First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Monotaglio met with George W. Bush twice to convey his intentions for the book. Although Bush himself did not grant further interviews, Monotaglio did talk to brother Jeb Bush, now governor of Florida, as well as George W.'s uncles and cousins. The 300 people Monotaglio interviewed for the book ranged from George W.'s Little League coach to high-ranking officials in his father's presidential campaigns. Monotaglio is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He points out that since the early 1950s, there have been only rare, random interludes when a Bush hasn't been in a prominent political office, governor, senator, congressman, or president. I asked if the family expected George W. to go into politics.
I think the level of expectation on him was incredible and really almost onerous in my final estimation. And the Bushes like to say, don't lay us out on the couch. It's kind of become one of their favorite public slogans, I think. In other words, don't try to psychoanalyze us. Don't try to read into, interior motivations, if you will. And I think that's well and fine for them to say that. But at the same time, I think that there are a lot of interior motivations that go into being the next son or the first son, as my book suggests in the title. In this particular family, the grandfather was an advisor to President Eisenhower, a confidant of President Eisenhower, and obviously George W.'s father, was the leader of the free world first and foremost. I think maybe more importantly, in some levels, he was the director of the CIA and held a lot of pretty important jobs in his life. And then beyond that, as I researched the family's history, the great grandfathers in the family also had incredible access to presidential authority and power, and served as advisors to different presidents. Presidents Hoover and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I think that George W. Really just inheriting that legacy, that dynasty, if you will, and simply being named George Walker Bush had a lot of expectations placed on him. I think it was understood that he was going into politics.
How close do you think he was to his father when he was growing up?
Interestingly, I thought initially that they would be very close, and in fact, after a lot of interviews, especially out in the Midland, West Texas area, which was a really interesting place, I think, in the 1950s when George W. was growing up there. He was born in New Haven, Connecticut, and at the age of 2 with his parents, they relocated from the Northeast, really from a kind of almost a gilded aristocratic environment, a well-heeled environment. They picked up and decided to move down to Texas and immerse themselves in frankly capitalizing on the latest Texas oil boom. And interestingly, they joined dozens and dozens of people from the Northeast, from Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Dartmouth, some of the finer academic settings, and folks from Wall Street who were investing out in this really desolate, dusty outback out in West Texas. I thought that in an environment like that, that a young George W. Bush would gravitate to his dad, be kind of under his dad's direct shadow. What I discovered was that the father was, in the words of George W.'s one of George W.'s uncles, the father George Herbert Walker Bush, was so, quote, hard-running at the time. He was really trying to capitalize on this oil boom and essentially become really one of the overnight Texas millionaires, that really George W. almost fell under the spell, if you will. He spent more time with his mom, and compounding the fact that the father was away from home a lot, just really chasing after this oil dream. The Bush family suffered really what in my estimation is really one of their true outstanding tragedies. George W.'s younger sister, Robin, passed away at the age of 4 from leukemia. George W. was 7 years old at that time. What happened as an outgrowth of that situation was that Barbara Bush began really enveloping and embracing and almost smothering George W. Bush. He was essentially almost raised as an only child, but in essence under his mom's wing, so to speak.
Describe a little bit the type of business that George Bush Sr. set up in Texas, how he tried to capitalize on the oil boom.
Sure, yeah. He started out almost on a low-level capacity learning, I think. He had been dispatched there. His father, Prescott Bush, had enormous ties all through the highest levels of American industry. He was really a profound industrialist, and the Bush family, I think, unbeknownst to me really until I started working this book, had incredible roots into late 19th century industrial power, and always seemed to be at the right place at the right time, which I think is almost a political hallmark, ultimately, of the first son, George W. Bush. He seems often to be in the right place at the right time. But essentially what happened is that the Bush family began taking note of the fact that post-World War II, there was an incredible thirst and hunger for oil as we were rebuilding and helping the world rebuild after World War II, and there were some new oil discoveries. People were beginning to drill a little bit deeper out in West Texas, and this was in the post-war period in the 1940s, a really desolate, dusty outback. Some people had described it as the Saudi Arabia of the Southwest, but they carefully analyzed the possibilities out there, and with some enormous funding from the Bush's extensive holdings in Wall Street and the upper echelons of industry around the country, George Herbert Walker Bush, George W.'s father, was almost really dispatched by the Bush family out to West Texas to kind of just get in on the action, frankly. And again, that didn't really distinguish him from maybe a lot of other people who were doing the same thing. But he came at it with a little bit more funding, a little bit more clout, and a little more oomph in his wallet than maybe some other people did. And what he started out doing was really just kind of taking the lay of the land and looking for good entry points. In the mid-50s, he began more actively drilling and taking more active interest in actually purchasing land and just punching a hole in the ground in almost a mythic kind of Texas way and hoping that something comes out of it. And it was really something out of your best dream if you're a Texas wildcatter. Almost every hole that they punched in the ground had begun to spurt with oil. And that was kind of the bedrock of the elder George Bush's personal fortune.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Minutaglio, and he's the author of the new book, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. George W. went to Yale, where he was the head of his fraternity, Delta Kappa Epsilon, which was also his father's fraternity. And as you point out in the book, this was a time in the late 60s when fraternities were starting to be seen as really anachronistic. They were seen as, the macho beer party atmosphere in an era when marijuana and the women's movement and the anti-war movement were having such a big impact on culture and politics. You quote a fellow Yale student as saying about George W. being head of the fraternity at Yale, Bush put himself somewhat off in a corner. It was an extremely liberal campus. What do you think the impact of being, the head of DKE was on George Bush during his college years, George W. Bush?
Sure. The ultimate impact, I think the impact here and now, is that it's left him with a very bitter taste in his mouth for the 1960s. I think he's really almost in some ways a professional derider of the 60s, if you will, when you really speak to him and listen to what he says.
You mean because the youth culture of the time was so opposed to what he was doing, the fraternity life?
That is exactly right. And even beyond that, I think that he saw, and it's not so much narrowly focused on the fraternity life, but also what that symbolized for him, his experience at Yale following in his father's footsteps and then his grandfather's footsteps and frankly speaking, dozens of other members of the Bush family that had all gone to Yale and all belonged to the same fraternity and the same secret societies at Yale. George W., I think, felt that he was, taking his place in line and almost carrying the mantle for this older kind of, gilded again, really almost the last dying days of a certain Ivy League way back at Yale in that time period. And some of his other friends called it the cusp years. Things were really changing. It was a halcyon period in American history. And in a way, George W. got whipsawed by it all. I don't think he saw it coming. And when he saw it coming, he didn't like it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Minutaglio, and he's the author of a new book called First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Minutaglio, and we're talking about his new book, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. The first time his name appeared in the New York Times, to your knowledge, was in an article about this controversial ritual at the fraternity of branding the insignia of the fraternity on the backs of pledges. This was in November of 1968, this article. Tell us more about the article and the controversy.
Sure. You know, it seems, I guess we've often heard the word hazing these days. We kind of, blur over it. I mean, it might not seem like a big deal, but to make it as a news item in the New York Times in that period in the late 60s when there's a lot going on in the world, you could probably guess that it was considered to be a little more dramatic event on campus than usual. And in a way, it kind of symbolizes George W.'s distaste for what he saw or was feeling at campus. Basically what happened, the Yale Daily News conducted an extensive investigation into the fraternity system, and it came away believing that a lot of kids at the school who were applying for the particular fraternities, including and especially Delta Kappa Epsilon, the one that George W. Bush had been president of, were quote, guilty of some pretty onerous hazing, including a form of branding, if you will, as the paper described it. And this set in motion a lot of things. There were some emergency meetings on campus. There were newspaper stories in the New York Times and the front page of the Hartford Current, the leading paper in the state of Connecticut and thus for the Yale campus in a way. There was just a lot of combustion about it, and I found it kind of interesting. In the middle of a time period when people are discussing the events that have been unfolding in Watts in the Deep South and obviously the war in Vietnam and the other really defining gigantic issues of the moment. George W.'s defining moment on campus at Yale anyway really revolved around a hazing episode.
So he really didn't participate in a larger political life on campus outside of like the politics of fraternities.
No, I theorize in my book that he was very apolitical, but in the sense that he almost was operating on an entirely different strata and level of political behavior. There were umpteen opportunities on campus to express your political opinion, especially at a place like Yale. There were all kinds of forums, debates, societies. There were speakers coming on. There were protests, both pro and con, and almost any issue that you could jump in and join and really express an opinion. And he really virtually completely ignored all of those. But beyond that, at home almost or away from campus, George W. was dealing with almost, quote, real politics in the sense that he was in service to his father and other members of the Bush family who were, beginning to escalate upward through the highest levels of American politics. So on one level, he was avoiding the usual kind of student entry points for political movement back then. But on another level, he was almost acting as if he, was in service to to entrenched establishment politics off campus.
He said that he hated what he saw at Yale, this idea of he hated this intellectual arrogance that he hoped he would never have. What do you think he was referring to?
Yeah, exactly. I think it has something to do with the reaction to the hazing episode, and there were other things, this sort of general sense that people who were involved in fraternities or even, as he was, in a secret society. Yale has a number of secret societies that limited admission, kind of secret societies that people are invited to join. George W. said that in college I was a quote, carefree lad. And he also said that I didn't want any, quote, heaviness to really ruin my time at school. And I think that he was a guy that was more interested in the process of being a student rather than kind of some of the other areas, almost the policy, if you will, of being a student. I think he was just more intrigued and happy with kind of hanging out on campus. Another writer has described him in this period as being an apolitical foam head, a guy that was divorced from politics, enjoyed chugging a lot of beer, drinking a lot, carrying on, being a fraternity guy. Among his other hallmarks at school back then were being picked up by the police in an event in downtown New Haven for stealing a Christmas wreath. He was detained by the police in Princeton, New Jersey after a football game for getting into a bit of a melee after a football game. And these were the kinds of things that really almost defined his, college experience. And I think in retrospect, what he saw was this, burgeoning sense of ambiguity on campus and around campuses around the country and this countercultural movement. And he saw that as almost an intellectual arrogance, a snobbery, and he really loathed it. And I think to this day still despises it.
Just a few days before George W. was about to lose his student deferment, he went to the National Guard to register. And the question has since arisen, did he pull strings to get into the National Guard at a time when a lot of young people wanted to get into the National Guard in the hopes that they wouldn't be sent to Vietnam? What did you find in your investigation? Do you think he pulled strings?
I think his background pulled strings for him, if that's a way to answer your question. I found no evidence that his father picked up the phone and called somebody and said, hey, get my son into the National Guard. There has been emerging evidence that some friends of the family did call folks in state government in Texas and ask them to basically put in a kind word. It's not illegal. It's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. And it happened a lot in the 60s and even the 70s. People had phone calls placed in their behalf. So I tend to believe that probably did happen for George W. But more importantly, I think what happened for him was that just by dint of where he was in life in society, both at Yale, but more importantly, he was going to be returning to Houston, Texas after school, or that's where his family was living. And it's pretty clear now that the particular unit that he went into in the Air National Guard was one that in some ways was populated by people who had come out of that same kind of upper end strata of society. And in fact, those kinds of folks were probably alerted or had a little bit more advanced knowledge than other people did about openings in the National Guard.
Do you think he wanted to get into the National Guard to avoid getting sent to Vietnam?
I think he went into the National Guard to not embarrass his father. I found that one of the most telling things that his friends kept telling me at different avenues in his life. One of his closest friends at Yale said to me the underlying reason George W. went into the National Guard was to perform any kind of military service and not embarrass his father, and really probably more importantly, not to derail his dad's chances to run for the White House to ultimately move into the Oval Office. As a parallel later on in his life, George W. Gave up drinking rather dramatically in 1986, and I found it so interesting that another one of his closest friends said that decision was really made in service to his father. He, at that point in 86, didn't want to derail his dad's attempts to win the presidency in 1988.
And after he gave up drinking, he started to really work for his father's campaign.
That's exactly right. He was even more assiduously in service to his father's political ambitions at that point.
Well, let's go back a little bit was it 1978 that George W. ran for Congress?
Exactly, yeah, in West Texas. Back out where he had lived, yeah.
What made him decide at that point to, you know, throw his hat in the ring?
He had always had political ambitions. I had discovered, and I think it's a little known fact, that even as early as 1971, after just being out of college for 2 years, he had flirted with the possibility of running for office in Texas, running for a state representative's office here, and had abandoned that, basically taking a look at his civic resume. At that point, it was pretty bankrupt, honestly speaking. There wasn't a lot on that resume that he could probably sell to voters. In 78, he happened to be in the right place at the right time. He had just gotten his feet wet a little bit in the oil industry. He had graduated from Harvard Business School in 75, replicating his dad's exact journey. He had left the Northeast, moved back to Midland, tried to get involved in the oil industry, mainly working with his dad's old friends. But when he was out there, coincidentally, a long-term entrenched Democrat was retiring in that particular congressional district. In fact, really the only congressman that had ever served in that district was retiring after several decades in office. And George W. just happened to be on the ground, essentially there with the Bush family network, incredible connections, resources to a lot of money, and beyond West Texas political clout. So he was just at the right place at the right time.
Bill Minutaglio is the author of the new book, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine. This week, Time profiles Steve Jobs, who is chairman of Pixar and interim CEO of Apple Computer, two iconic late 90s American companies. By Bantam Books, publishers of A Very Private Woman by Bina Burley, the story of the life and mysterious death of Mary Meyer, in trade paperback, and by Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion about presidential hopeful George W. Bush with his biographer, Bill Minutaglio. And there are over 6 million .com addresses for the Internet. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the .com craze.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Minutaglio, author of a new biography of presidential hopeful George W. Bush and the Bush family dynasty called First Son. Minutaglio is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. When we left off, we were talking about George W.'s first political race, his failed run for Congress in 1978. How did losing that first congressional campaign affect him politically and personally?
Personally, it reminded him of almost really the sense or the way that people have been perceiving or had been perceiving some members of the Bush family. He lost the race because he was painted in royal colors as a gilded aristocrat, quote, tool of the Eastern kingmakers, which was a charge that had been leveled against his dad when his dad was getting started in Texas politics. That really, you know, he was a silver spoon kid who had gone to all the right schools and suddenly alighted in West Texas and was just here to run for Congress because there was an opening. And it sent a real hard message to him that one, I need to perhaps do a better job, at least here in Texas, of reinventing myself or correcting that perception of me as a gilded aristocrat from somewhere else. I need to to work harder to sell myself or convey an impression of myself as a real dyed-in-the-wool West Texan kind of guy. So it really rocked him on his heels. It really did, and it caused him to almost kick back, I think, and analyze, and again, a search for a better opening. It also reminded him at that point that he needed to have that civic resume. And I think he very assiduously and carefully and in a calculating, frankly, way began building that resume and filling in the spots where he saw deficiencies.
What did he do to build the resume?
Well, he tried to stay the course in the oil industry and make a lot of money, which is always a good thing, I guess, to do these days if you're running for politics. It seems to be a lesson that he's learned pretty well lately. But he tried to stay the course. Unfortunately, he got a little whipsawed by that too. He didn't profit from the same luck and timing as his father had had in the 1950s. Basically, the oil bust kind of washed over him, and he had marginal success, so to speak, really in the oil game. But he established more contacts. He essentially made a lot of friends and assiduously tried to retain contact with people who could probably help him later on. And then later on, post oil industry, he gravitated into a politically fortuitous situation. He bought himself a 1.8% piece of the Texas Rangers baseball team here, and with that business move, his profile was astronomically elevated. He did that in large part to raise his political profile, and that kind of helped him. He was perceived then as a part of apple pie and baseball in America, and he was also appointed himself to be sort of the out front spokesperson for the team. So he was nominally seen almost as the owner. He was often frequently described that way.
How did his partnership with the other owners of the team help him politically?
Well,
and financially.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And that the financial part is really easy to lay out. He invested $606,000 in the Texas Rangers and walked away by some estimations about $15 million over the span of about a decade. So that's a pretty good return on your investment. I'm not sure what the exact percentage is, but that's a pretty healthy return.
My guest is Bill Minutaglio, the author of the new book First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Minutaglio writes for the Dallas Morning News. So at what point did George W. start working for his father's political campaigns?
It was really he's always worked on behalf of his dad, actually. I mean, he started out in 1964 when his father was first running for the Senate in Texas. So he's always been exposed to power and worked on behalf of his dad. But to really talk about acute political involvement where he actually seemed to be earning his bread and butter, so to speak, you'd have to look at the mid 1980s evolution of the campaign of the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign for the presidency.
I think it was during that campaign that George W. became his father's bridge to the far right of the party, especially the religious right. Why was he given that position?
His father was very, very worried about the emergence of a group that he rarely understood. Within the Bush campaign at that period, they would almost ominously, I think, refer to the Christian right and the evangelical groups as quote, the movement. It almost had an ominous undertone to it. And they had a hard time understanding who these people were, where they were coming from, and really beyond that, what the net effect that the quote, movement, the Christian right, the hard Christian evangelical movement would have on the chances for Bush to go further. But there were a lot of questions then about the elder George Bush. Is he a lot of questions posed by the hard right. Is he strong enough? Is he iron-limbed enough to do the right thing? Is he really going to be like Ronald Reagan? And George W.'s role was to essentially recorrect or inform people that the Bushes really did have the stomach and the fire and the belly to do these things. Now, he was a pretty good messenger because he can be a pretty insistent and argumentative at times, even hot-tempered kind of fellow. So I think when some people met him, they saw a guy who had a lot of bark and some bite.
How do you think his role as the bridge from the Bush campaign to the religious right, how do you think that role is affecting him now in his own campaign?
Well, it's interesting now just lately because people like Gary Bauer and Pat Buchanan have been essentially suggesting that George W. Bush is really almost like his father. I'm not sure they're articulating it exactly that way, but it's very interesting to me as his biographer to see the same arguments being leveled against George W. Bush as were leveled against his dad. You know, Gary Bauer and Buchanan and others have basically accused George W. of speaking empty words, mealy-mouthed words, and really, in essence, not having the spine to follow up the Republican Revolution, the 1994 Republican Revolution now, and even probably beyond that, the Reagan Revolution.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Minutaglio, and he's the author of the new book, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Minutaglio, author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. It seems that in George W.'s current campaign that although he doesn't in public speeches espouse the same platform as, say, the Christian Coalition, that Pat Robertson seems to be behind him. Do you think that they have a relationship that goes back to George W.'s days as the bridge between the Bush campaign and the religious right? Do you think that there's some level of understanding or trust built on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I don't think so, to be honest. I think that they're still kind of eyeing George W. And keeping him at arm's length. I also think there's a sense of inevitability about George W. right now that's causing a lot of harder-edged conservatives and people on the far right to jump on the bandwagon. He's so far ahead and has accumulated almost $60 million in his war chest. It's almost hard to sit down and argue with him and really almost, I guess, spin your wheels, frankly, at this point by supporting somebody else. But I think they're still watching him real closely. And, you know, he's had in recent weeks some trouble. He's been distancing himself a little bit from the Republican Party in some ways and suggesting that the GOP needs to be a little more empathetic. I do know that he and Robertson have parted ways on certain issues. One of the really infamous incidents in George W.'s tenure as governor was the execution of a woman named Carla Faye Tucker, a convicted pickaxe murderer who was on Texas death row, who was put to death here. Pat Robertson believed that she was essentially a born-again Christian and had interceded in her behalf and sought hopefully some clemency for her, or at least a reprieve on her execution from the governor, and he chose not to grant that. So I know there was a little bit of a difficulty with them and that issue.
Mm-hmm. If If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Minutaglio, and we're talking about his new book, First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Another position that George W. filled for his father was being head of what was called the scrub team. What was that?
Yeah, that's one of those kind of backroom teams or organizations that you probably presume exist and maybe worry about, but in fact really did exist. Basically, what it was a loyalty enforcing and monitoring group that acted on behalf of his father as his father was moving into the White House. George W., unofficially was known as the loyalty enforcer for his father. You know, some folks I've talked to said he was tantamount to being Sonny Corleone in the Godfather books, in the sense that he would go out and do some manly defense on behalf and offense on behalf of his father. The scrub team was basically a group that met to determine who would be granted political favors and basically get jobs in the White House. And George W. oversaw that group as his father made the transition into the White House.
That's a position that must have given him a lot of power, since he could give power or take it away.
Absolutely. He was right there in the center of determining, you know, who would physically work in the White House alongside his dad in other positions, and looked at recommendations, offered his own recommendations. And I think it's another aspect of his life that a lot of people just don't know about, the level of access to power. I guess you would presume obviously, that he was hanging around the White House a lot and meeting his mom and dad there and therefore had obviously a geographical access that was there. But beyond that, he really did hold the keys to certain levels of authority, I believe, in government in Washington.
One of the things that a lot of voters in America would like to know is the answer to a question that you decided not to investigate yourself, which is, did George W. Do cocaine or other drugs in his past? He has declined to answer that, although he has implied that if he has done anything, it hasn't been in the past 25 years. Why have you declined to really investigate the answer to that question?
Sure. Yeah, I did investigate it, but not to exclusivity, I guess, would be the right answer. And as word spread really around the country that I was working on this biography, the first biography of George W., I began receiving rumors myself. People would call me and correspond with me in different ways and essentially send me down a variety of rabbit trails. I determined in time that you could spend a lot of time chasing your tail doing that. I probably could have spent really almost all the time that I had allotted to my project on that issue alone. And I decided really, I hope this doesn't sound sanctimonious or pious, but I decided really that my role as a biographer was to look at the broader spectrum of his life, but as well as best I could to address the issue. And I hopefully did address the issue, but it's not in an exclusive or dominating way.
George W. has said, I'm going to tell people I made mistakes and that I've learned from my mistakes. And if they like it, I hope they give me a chance. And if they don't like it, they can find somebody else to vote for. I think the reason why a lot of people feel that his drug experiences are perhaps more relevant than they might even be for somebody else is that he has been so tough on drugs in Texas. And there's a lot of people who are serving, you know, long sentences for drug use, for carrying drugs, and whereas he was able to outgrow his mistakes there in prison for their mistakes, so I wonder, you know, in the light of that, how relevant a question you think his rumored drug use in the past is.
Oh, it's an absolutely relevant question, especially in terms of the political nature or the dimension of life in Texas. If you're a convicted drug abuser, possessor in Texas, it's not a happy day for you. You will be subject to some pretty onerous penalties. And obviously, some people would say that's a laudatory thing when weighed against, the possibility that George W. hasn't been entirely precise about his exact involvement, with drugs. It does take on, obviously, an acutely political dimension and probably causes people to wonder why the lack of precision exactly, what It's almost a double standard, I suppose you'd argue. And I can say I really believe this, that no matter what the final conclusion is or estimation is on this particular issue, it will be something that will be with him forever. I think whether he succeeds in his run for the presidency or not, it's something that people are going to talk about for a real long time and will be with him really until his grave.
What are some of the biggest controversies that you've covered pertaining to George W. Bush while covering social issues for the Dallas Morning?
Oh, the biggest one, sure, that's a great question. The biggest one so far was an attempt during a previous legislative session in 1997 to essentially privatize the welfare system and, broadly speaking, a giant portion of the social services system in Texas. And by privatize, basically, the ultimate agenda, if you will, for Governor Bush here was to have data processing and even defense contractors around the country participate in essentially administering social services and welfare in this state. And I can tell you the system here is gigantic. It's larger than it is in some countries. And in fact, I know that some countries around the world were actually watching, had come to Texas to see what Governor Bush was going to do in terms of essentially moving control of the social services system and the welfare system here really into private hands. It was a very, very controversial proposal, ultimately not really successful, but I thought an incredibly interesting and insightful maneuver on his part.
Who opposed that and who supported it?
It was opposed at the highest levels by the Clinton administration, directly by Donna Shalala and Bill Clinton. And it was even more assiduously and ardently opposed by the AFL-CIO, folks that were representing a lot of unionized state employees who would have been affected. And there's a very little told story in Texas, but one that I think says a lot about George Bush. The fact that he's still at heart a Republican, he believes in deconstructing government and essentially opening up opportunities for big business.
So was this seen in Texas as an example of compassionate conservatism, privatizing the welfare business?
Yeah, at that point he wasn't really using that term, but I could probably see how he would suggest that it was, that what we're doing now is letting people help themselves. We're going to let the private sector essentially move in here and help people help themselves as opposed to having big brother, big government get people to help themselves, which is one of the underlying tenets or philosophies of his compassionate conservatism.
Now, when he ran for governor of Texas, you say he asked his father to stay away from the election. Why?
I think he had really studied his family's history and his legacy. I think he looked back to 1978 when he was beat. I think he also looked at why his dad was beat, and I think he determined in 1992. I think he determined that, wow, we're in this new generation. I'm a young baby boomer. I'm the GOP's Clinton, if you will, in the sense that I'm a post-war baby boomer. And I don't really want to be burdened by the baggage that might have gotten my father elected or unelected. I don't want to be burdened by the things that dragged him down. And I think he saw his father almost as a liability and specifically asked him, please stay away. It's probably not going to help me for me to be affiliated with you. I need to prove that I can do something on my own. And beyond that, you represent a generation that's maybe past, politically speaking.
What's George Bush's role now in his son's presidential campaign?
He's been pretty quiet, as you can tell, and I think that's been a hallmark of a lot of their relationship as George W. and even Jeb have become governors of prominent states. He's I think, operated in the background as a quiet advisor when they gather at Kennebunkport for the annual gatherings at the Seaside Compound, the 100-year-old Seaside Compound up in Maine. The father obviously dispenses some wisdom and advice on things, but by and large, I think with his son's help, he's understood that it's probably all in all politically beneficial for the family at large for him to take a back seat, a less visible role. I think intuitively the Bushes distrust a particular word, and that word is dynasty. You know, it's on the cover of my book. And
I was going to point that out.
Yeah. I'm not sure they're going to like that a whole lot, but I think it's certainly appropriate, and it can be read both in a positive and negative way, I think, the word dynasty. But they particularly acutely dislike it. They've said so often over and over again, and it's something they think smacks of royalty and aristocracy and almost a monarchy, if you will, in some ways. It's just something they don't like. They think it conveys the wrong message. And I think toward that end, the elder Bush has decided to take a very less visible role in his son's life.
Well, Bill Minutaglio, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Bill Minutaglio is the author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on dot-com fever. This is Fresh Air. The current mania for internet commerce seems to be focused on the single suffix .com. People talk about .com companies, .com billionaires, and .com neighborhoods. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the .com fever from San Francisco, where the madness is at its height.
I was talking to a woman who'd grown up in Paris and had recently arrived in the Bay Area to teach French at Berkeley. She was in a daze over the San Francisco housing prices, which have been blown to stratospheric levels by the same internet wind that piles up dollars in drifts on the sidewalks out here. I want in, she said. Where do I sign up for America.com? She's not alone. There's nothing so powerful as a suffix whose time has come. Time magazine ran a cover story a few weeks ago on the Bay Area startup culture that was called GetRich.com, and Fortune called its cover story .com fever. Network Solutions describes itself as the dot-com people, and Sun Micro is using the slogan, "We're the dot in dot-com." Actually, I'm not sure what that last one is supposed to mean. It sounds to me sort of like saying, "We're the apostrophe in apostrophe S," but it gets the mantra right. Who knew? Certainly no one back in the mid-1980s when the present system of internet naming was taking shape. Back then, the idea was just that commercial users would put the .com suffix in their email addresses after their company names. As late as 1992, there were only a few thousand .com addresses in all, nowhere near so many as there were for the educational institutions whose addresses ended in .edu. The .com craze really began in the mid-90s, as the web took off and companies began to realize that their web address could become part of their brand. One of the first major companies to go in for this was Procter & Gamble. As the story has it, a bunch of P&G network support people got punchy at a party and started registering every name they could think of, not just product names like Charmin.com and Vaporub.com, but also a bunch of generic names like Dandruff.com, Pimples.com, and Diarrhea.com. I don't know if the story's true, but it would explain why P&G misspelled deodorant when they first registered Deodorant.com. In any event, the rush was on. Tidy Cat scooped up litter.com and Ragu scarfed up eat.com. And Charles Schwab registered schwabsucks.com to forestall any disgruntled customers from getting there first. By 1997, the number of .com addresses passed the million mark. People were getting used to the system, and they stopped reciting the http://www stuff every time they gave you a URL, which made these things a lot easier to pass around and post on billboards. By then, the .com suffix had become a talisman of the e-commerce boom. Startups were taking to adding it to the name of the business itself on the model of Amazon.com. Of course, there's nothing new in making a chic address a part of your business name. Just look at Saks Fifth Avenue or Fredericks of Hollywood. The only difference is that in the dot-com world, there's no limit to the available street frontage, provided you can find an unused name to stick up over your place of business. By now, there are over 6 million dot-com names registered, and the coffers of the English vocabulary are pretty much emptied out. Wired magazine did a search not long ago on about 25,000 standard English words and found that more than 90% of them were already taken. As of now, you can still get maggot.com or gluttony.com. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's somebody down the street getting together a business plan so they can grab those names, too. It's true that .com isn't the only game in town. There are already other suffixes available like .us and .net. And there are plans afoot to introduce a whole shelf of new, more specific suffixes like .store, .biz, .movie, and .sex. But it isn't likely that any of this will ease the demand for .com names. Showing up for your IPO with a .net address on your business card is sort of like trying to get into Studio 54 wearing a pair of Birkenstocks. And if you're casting about for a new .com name for your own startup, as you almost certainly are, you can rest assured that there are still a lot of possibilities left. There are all the e-thises and the i-thats, and we're starting to see URLs with full sentences in them, like whatisthematrix.com and haveigotagirlforyou.com. Some of those are kind of obscure, but if your startup is flush with venture capital, you can still buy a more common name from one of the speculators who had the foresight to register it a couple of years ago. The name computer.com recently sold for $500,000. And WallStreet.com went for over $1 million to some people in Venezuela who were starting a gambling site. Those figures make the prices of the internet stocks themselves seem downright prudent by comparison. But the commerce in dot-coms comes with a digital territory. It's the price you pay for setting up business in a retail district where the streets are dark and featureless and there's no way to find anything except by punching names into the void. As T.S. Eliot might have put it, I gotta use words when I link to you.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From WGBH Boston, producer of Mystery, airing P.D. James, An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, tonight and next Thursday on PBS. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Trust, the private and powerful family behind The New York Times by Susan E. Tift and Alex S. Jones, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new recording by Tony Bennett pays tribute to Duke Ellington. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature our 1998 interview with Tony Bennett. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.